Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 20th, 2002. And this session at Holden is entitled Job, Jennifer, and Jesus, The Pain of Suffering Unjustly and Alone. It is presented by Norman Hubbell, and it is tape number HAN 2002-15. Let's listen in.
I'm Norm Hubbell, and we're ready to tape. For those of you who don't know, I come from Australia, but I spent almost 20 years in this country teaching in St. Louis, and during that time I became an Old Testamentler. I studied the Old Testament. I do lots of things. Tomorrow night I'll do the Purple Peltry to children of all ages. And that's a show, a performance for kids. Of all the areas of my study, I've studied and done many, many things. Children's stuff during the 60s. I did coffee houses and wrote teenage books and popular books and Lord knows what else. But the book that probably I am known for in the world of Old Testamentalists is the book of Job. And my commentary on the book of Job, which came out in 1985, is the one thing that I think of mine that might last a few years. The rest will fade away, I'm sure. Disposable literature, at most, is. And so Job has been something I have lived with and worked with for a long time, and it's functioned for me not only as a work of scholarship, but also as a book that's provided meaning for life and meaning, and has become now, for me, a vehicle for looking at a kind of process of healing for people who have great pain of soul and pain of heart. And those of you who, after today, wish to, are invited to come next door to the Creekside or have a ritual of healing. And that currently in Australia, whenever we have the Eucharist now, we also have the three of the body and then the blood. And then after that, if somebody wants to, they can nod, and I, or whoever the pastor is, will then give a healing blessing as well. And the blessing runs something like, may the healing power of Christ's body and blood reach deep into your heart, your soul, and your body to bring you healing. Come, Lord Jesus, and heal. So that's a simplified version of it, depending on who the person is. So, and also reiterate what I said last time. Last year, I did a series of sermons which has this title, Job, Jennifer, and Jesus, one each of 5 Sundays in Lent. And as a result of that, all sorts of things happened in the congregation in terms of people opening up to face what had happened in their lives and began the process of healing for quite a lot of people. And then healing processes and practices were included in the Eucharist. And I think the Eucharist is the best place for them on a routine basis, because the Eucharist is a healing meal according to our Lutheran tradition. Even though we don't always focus on that, it is so. So, reviewing a little from yesterday. We started yesterday, and I know some of you probably are new and weren't here yesterday. I'll just give you a brief overview of what we said yesterday. We looked at the initial story of Job, and how Job, after he had been framed by God, and was given, everything was taken from him, he begins, in the first stage of Job is one of denial. And he says, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord. You know, he's piously saying what he's supposed to say. And that kind of problem is what many people face. They hear the pastor come and say, the Lord, you know, whatever, something nice, something's supposed to make you feel good when it makes you feel worse. And I will repeat the story. When I was a boy, when I was at seminary, actually, we came running. We were home the day before Christmas. And my brother and I were playing tennis. We got a phone call which said, your house is on fire. We raced home, almost tipped the truck over. Got home and the house was in flames. Everybody from everywhere came. And the Lutheran pastor came too, from wandering to and fro on the earth. He said, Norman, Norman, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away, and blessed be the name of the Lord. That made a huge impression on me. I felt like, And so it is. Last time we've looked at quite a lot of those kind of pious answers that people give when people go through extreme suffering, answers that really you have a right to say shove it, and to go on and say, look, that doesn't help right now. I want to go through the anguish. I need to go through the pain. In the second phase of it, we looked at how after the 7 days of Job's waiting and sitting, he then screams. And so you have Job screaming, curse the day that I was born, curse this, curse that. He curses and screams bloody murder. He curses everything but God. He almost gets there. And he's at the verge of suicide. And he said, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful to be dead? Wouldn't it be wonderful to be in the land of the dead where everybody's peaceful and quiet and you don't have to listen to the slave master and you don't have to have God hound you. Wouldn't it be wonderful to be dead? So you have Job at the verge of suicide. And the way, big question, why should I be alive if I've got no point in living? When there's nowhere for me to go, there's no point in living. And that great why screams out at you in the opening cry of Job. Parallel to that is the story of Jennifer and the first part of her story. And she is a simple woman who has a child by the name of James and a husband who's a bit rough. And she works in a restaurant. And then one night, the police come and say, your house has been burnt down, and your son James has been burnt to death. Her husband is gone. She's lost her husband, her life, her home, and everything, and she breaks down. And I visit her in an institution, and I'll repeat one bit. She said, look, I really don't want to go on living. I don't want to live. And I don't have the courage to take my life. I said, well, you have to. She said, there's no other option, I said. She said, oh, yes, there is. That I have never been born. And that's exactly what Job says. That I had never been born. And so this wishing away, living on the verge of suicide, in despair, as you cry out. And then discovering that the depths of her despair and her anguish and her crying were not just that her boy died, but as it unfolds slowly, I find out that she had been abused by her uncle time and again when she was a girl of a teenager. And her story and her pain goes back now, and she's reliving all of that as well. And when I tell this as part of sermons, you see, not just simply as a passing thing, not just as a Bible study, but this was a series of sermons. Lots of people who otherwise would never even think about it or talk about it came, and we have opportunity to scream. Giving people the right to scream and say, damn it, God, why should this happen to me? It's absolutely senseless, pointless suffering. It's very clear, Job is innocent of anything. And the suffering is totally, totally senseless. There's no point in trying to pretend it's not. Say, oh, well, it's designed to test your character or make you, because God really loves you. Well, there's nothing of that. Job is suffering senseless, horrible suffering. Then we come to stage two. Well, I'm going to go through three or four stages in order to get this through today. But what happens next is in the chapters that follow, Job time and time again, he is told by his three friends, who are supposed to be his advocates and comforters, in fact, they're just the opposite. They do just the opposite. When they look at Job, what is the answer? What is the interpretation of Job's suffering that the friends make?
He must have done something.
God, nobody could be that badly, that cursed, and not have done something wrong. So you have, and this happens time and time and time again. Somebody is suffering some great ill of some kind. And people look at it from this side and say, if you're suffering that, therefore there must have been some great sin or wrong or evil that you've done. Now, sometimes sin will produce something that's a disastrous thing. If you have people who are running around having free loading and free intercourse everywhere, they might well get syphilis, but that's because of their wrong. But just because somebody's sick and ill doesn't mean that they sin. You cannot argue backwards from suffering to sin. You cannot argue backwards from suffering to sin. You cannot argue that because somebody is going through hell, that person deserves it in some way or another. And the friends do it endlessly, chapter after chapter after chapter. First of all, they say, well, now God is really disciplining you. You should just straighten out and everything will be okay. And Zophar comes along and says, Job, if you think very carefully, you know, I think it might be your children that did it wrong. They're the problem. And finally, you know, there's a whole sequence of these things, and I'm not going to have time to go through them. I'll just read a little bit where Zophar says, he says, look, Job, I'll tell you what. If you think very closely, you realize that you deserve more than you're getting. In other words, you've sinned more, and what you're getting is really coming off easy. So you get a whole series of these people, these efforts to interpret the suffering in terms of some sin. And Job is saying, quite unequivocally, I have not sinned. I am innocent. Don't let anybody ever interpret Job with the assumption that Job ever confesses that he sinned. He doesn't. He vehemently, from the beginning to the end, and this is a story about innocent suffering. That's what it's about. That's a fundamental theme of the book. What? How do you interpret a book per situation when somebody has suffered? Suffered innocently, unjustly, unfairly. And it happens all over the world, as you well know. Now, Jennifer, likewise. Jennifer, likewise. She began to recognize that people who are not accepting began to see that she must have been to blame. And it's very easy for you, if people say you must have done something wrong, to take it on and say, well, I must have been to blame somehow. And it happens with people, especially teenagers like that, who have been abused when they're younger, and it was a horrible, dirty thing, and they feel the shame. What happens? They take it on. I must have done something wrong. Couldn't possibly. And so you easily appropriate the accusation of guilt or the implication of guilt and wrong when you don't have to, when it's not your fault. That happens so often. And in Job, the important thing about this book is that even after 30 chapters of effort of the friends to try and make him feel guilty, Job never, ever flinches. He says, I have done nothing to deserve this. Yeah. Now, another side of this is that frequently when this happens, and you are at the middle of this. You start off with the world, and here you are as an individual who's suffering. You've got all these friends around you, all these kind of people around you. And bit by bit, what happens? Thank you. You are abandoned. And so the second major thing is the whole concept that Job is abandoned. Job is left without anybody. Now, three friends who are supposed to be beside him as friends, but in fact they're doing just the opposite, making him feel more and more distant from them. And often this, when you actually do come to terms with this, and you face it, people will leave you. When Jennifer finally told her story, once when she said she was very ill, she told her parents, she said, "Look, my uncle is doing this. He's abusing me." And the parents, what?
Denial.
You won't believe it. At so many cases, the first thing, if ever your child comes to you and says, "I've been touched or abused or hurt," don't ever say, "Are you sure?" The moment you say that, you have hinted that you're not lying. You must say, "Tell me. I've been through this so often." Even the suggestion that you don't believe them, it's going to have to take a long time to overcome. So it's important that we say, "All right, what happened?" And you believe that person. In the courts in Australia, it's very hard to get the justice to ever accept the word of the child, because it's the word of the child against the word of the man. And I know I've been through it. It's hell. But you, as a parent, must be right there and say, "I believe every word you say." It's very, very rare that somebody can talk to them. It's too sick. But the sense of being abandoned, that means that you need to have somebody who is going to be your friend. Somebody who will be your advocate. So that even if you're going through hell and dying and whatever else you're going through, there is one person at least who's going to be right there beside you. Preferably more than one, but at least one. Now in chapter 6 of Job, we're not going to do Bible study now. I ask you to read each verse because it's not going to get through otherwise. If you look at chapter 6 of Job, he talks about what a friend is all about. He says, you people, you come in here and you offer me all these platitudes. I come to you like I'm coming to a stream for a drink, and all I get is dry. There's nothing left. And then in 6:14, if you ever want to look it up, unfortunately the translation is not always that good. 6:14 is a key text, a key line in Job's understanding. And I go back to the Hebrew and look at it, because that most of us translators don't want to take the honest text. They don't really want to be honest with the text. They want to sound nicer. The text says, if a person loses faith in God, you need a friend who'll be loyal. A loyal friend is one who's there when you lose faith in God. Now, I think that's a powerful statement. Job has not lost faith in the sense he doesn't believe there's a God. He believes there's a God, but he's lost faith in God as a God who actually cares for him or is concerned about him, because God has done nothing but send him all these disasters quite unjustly. So he's lost faith in God as a God who's worth anything, or as God of love, or any of those kind of things that we like to say. God is a God who has simply hounded him. And so all the way through he has these portraits of God. "God, you're like a spider. You keep looking at me, waiting for me to make a mistake." It's a play called J.B. by Archibald MacLeish. Anybody know it? Mm-hmm. Fabulous play. It's full of poets. It's a poetic play. But it's a wonderful play. And there's a scene in there where it's eternal, implacable spider. The portrait of God is the eye. The eye watching relentlessly. And he says, Job says, God, just look away for a minute. I can't even swallow my spit. Powerful stuff. So this sense of needing someone to be your advocate when everybody has abandoned you. The same was true to Jennifer. Nobody believed her. And all her friends abandoned her. And you find her in an institution about to, in total despair. Where does it go? Where does the story change? What happens? How do you move from this total despair, total abandonment, to move forward? And that's what makes the book of Job so remarkable. And a lot of people will probably not even be conscious of what Job does unless you read it closely. Because Job does what I would encourage anybody in this condition to do. First, to scream bloody murder and have it out. But Job, after the question of screaming and after screaming at his friends and after all that screaming, he then says, I got a plan. I want justice. I want justice. Now, let's give ourselves a court. Here's the judge. On this side, you've got the prosecuting attorney, or in biblical terms, the accuser, otherwise known as the Satan. The Satan, you see, is not the devil in the Old Testament yet. It's simply the one who's the accuser in the courtroom. And on the other side, you've got your defense attorney, DA, or if you like, your advocate. Down here is the person who is on trial, the plaintiff, or the victim, or whatever. Now, I sometimes, when I have classes, act this out and put different people in that role, but we don't have that time. From the point of view of the friends, where is Job?
Victim.
Right there. And the friends think they're here. They say they're here, but really they're here. They say they are the advocates, the friends, quote, 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 but in reality, everything they do is to accuse them and say, well, God, and where's God?
Judge.
And God is there. That's the traditional picture of where people are set, located, fixed, functioning. In our minds, even in our minds, we put God at the top. Now, the unbelievably radical thing about the book of Job, is that Job says in chapters 9 and 10, he thinks about it. What I'd like to do, I'd like to put God on trial. I want to put God on trial. God, you're the one who's done this. And you've got to answer for it. So I'd like to bring God and put him on trial. And I'll just quote one of two lines in chapter 9 so you can hear what it sounds like. If, the problem, says Job, however, if I summoned, this is literal now, if I summoned God to court and God answered, I don't really believe he would listen to my voice. The way he's treated me so far, I don't expect him to listen to me. God would crush me with a whirlwind, which of course is exactly what he did do, or so it seems. He did come with a whirlwind. God would crush me with a whirlwind, and if it's a trial of strength, well, God's the mighty one, and I can't win that. I can't win an arm wrestling contest. And if it's a trial at court, then comes the big question. If it's a trial, of course, who can arraign God for me? Who can bring God to court to trial? How can you bring God to trial? That's his big question. How do I get God on the witness stand? How can I make God testify? The problem is, if God does appear in court, he's a bit overwhelming. He says, I blow me away, I'll get a blasted, there'll be a great glory flash, and all this to me, he talks about this extraordinary problem of how the, what happens if you do God, if you do get God, how can I put a sort of a mask there so at least I can survive? You know, God is not that easy to handle when you put him in court. But Job goes through all these reflections of how and where and whether he could bring God to court. Several chapters. Then he says that he has his second idea. All right, let's ask the question. What I need somebody here who can get God to court. I need somebody on my side. Right now I've got God against me and my friends against me. I need an advocate. I need somebody who's on my side. And there are three places that he does, chapter 9, 16, and 19, where he explores this idea. And I could find my glasses.
Yep. Right on the bottom.
Right there.
Oh, there. If you don't have one, it's hard to find. All right, chapter 9. I'll just take these three passages because they are crucial for understanding that Job is looking for somebody to be an advocate. All right? Verse 9:15. Though I am innocent, see, it's unequivocal. I cannot answer him. Answer is a legal term. Answer him in court, that means. Legally. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. In other words, he's calling God the accuser, God the Satan. If I summoned him and he answered me, I don't believe he would, well, listen to my voice. Though I'm innocent, verse 20, my own mouth appears to condemn me. And going all the way down to verse 32. For I am not a mortal. For he is not a mortal, sorry. He is not a mortal as I am, that I might answer him. That is, answer in court. That we might come to trial together. 23. There's no umpire between us.
Yep.
Umpire is the one translation. Who can put his hand on my shoulder, on his shoulder. What Job is saying, if you had somebody who could actually mediate, put a hand on the shoulder and say, all right, now you two stand there together and we're going to have this out. It's very hard to put your hand on God's shoulder and a hand on Job's shoulder and do that. There isn't anybody around. But he's reflecting on the possibility of a mediator, you see? He's anticipating the Christ concept in a fascinating way. Extraordinary. Then he does it again in chapter 16. This time he said, well, if I don't get a mediator, I'm going to have somebody who will actually be on my side and testify. 9:16-18. O earth, remember the story about Cain and Abel where the earth cries out, O earth, do not cover my blood. Let my cry find no resting place. For even now, in fact, I reckon, there's a witness in heaven that will vouch for me. He might die in this sultan, but somebody's watching. Going back to the story at the beginning, remember Satan was watching what happened. And God says, Did you watch? What did you see? Now he's allowing for the possibility that somebody's watching what God did and will testify. And that leads to the third text, which is famous, and you all know it, but you don't have it in this context possibly. Chapter 19. Then he says, I want my words written down, verse 23, inscribed in a book with a pen of iron, engraved in a rock. I know I'm innocent. I want it all written down because he says, I know that my what? Redeemer lives. And even if my body is dead and the worms are eating me, he will stand up and testify for me at the end somewhere one day. So Job is ready to say, even if I'm dead, I will one day have either an advocate or a witness or here a redeemer. That is, somebody will actually redeem my name and declare me innocent. I didn't. I was innocent. So Job's cry for justice is a cry. He's going to reclaim his life, reclaim his position, reclaim his soul, and one day he believes somebody will clear him. That's where the Redeemer passage fits. It has nothing to do with the resurrection, it has to do with Job's cry. Questions? People might have, before I roll on, finish this story. Jennifer had a phone call one night, several years after the fire, and her husband had called and wanted to talk with her. He disappeared for 2-3 years. And that phone call stung her back into action. When she knew she had contact with the person who was at fault, she came alive again. She wanted to face him, she wanted to have it out, she wanted justice. It was fascinating. And that was the point at which it was possible to begin to move forward again. And bit by bit, we looked at how to face it. But she realized that the person she really wanted to face was not her husband, but her uncle, who had abused her years before. So the search was to find the old man and enable an advocate to confront him. An advocate to be with her, for her to confront him. And she made the statement which will always stay with me. My husband may have stolen my son, but my uncle stole my soul. And I want it back. How does Job end it all? Chapters 29 to 31 of Job are the last words of Job. But they aren't just any words. Those three chapters, Job assumes he's now in the court. He doesn't now say, I wish I were in court. He assumes he's in court, and he states his case. This is my case, God. This is my life. This is what I've done, and this is what you've done. And he states his case in three very, very forthright chapters. And at the end of that case, it's very clear. The very end of this case, his legal cry, his legal claim is made. Chapter 31, reading from verse 35. Oh, that I had someone to hear me. That means to hear me in court. That's a legal term. And he says, here is my signature. He signed his document. He signed his declaration of innocence to the court. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. Who's that? Who's his adversary?
God.
Now I want God to put his case down. I want you to write your case, God. Oh, that I had God's case, my adversary's case. Then there's a little touch of humor, which I often think is quite surprising, but it's here. If I got God's document, if God wrote his case down, it was put on paper, or whatever, he had parchment then, but if he wrote it down, then what I'd do, I would bind it on my head like a crown. I'd put it on my head, and then I would walk up forward and I would tell God everything about my innocence. So Job has gone to approach God with God's accusation sitting on his head. It's a fascinating little touch of humor at the end of a very poignant and powerful. It's almost like saying, Job, as a momentary act of total defiance at the very end. Touch of just brilliance on the part of the writer. So Job gets to the point where he believes he will be vindicated somehow. He still assumes God needs to be on trial, and he has stated his case formally, officially, and declared it and signed it. Now, am I clear? Am I clear? Okay. What happens next? Job has stated his case, everything's declared, and you say, well, you know, it's a bit presumptuous. And so a little fellow by the name Elijah pops up. He says, Job, you're a bit of, you know, just forget it. I'll be your advocate. I'll tell you everything. I'll give you all the answers. You don't have to worry about a thing. So you have this wonderful little anticlimax where Elijah sort of pipsqueaks. It's a young guy who jumps up and gives all the answers like somebody else. And some of it's very interesting stuff. We read some of it for chapel the other night. I said, God, this is from Elijah. But it's interesting. You just pick it out from anywhere. You don't know the context where it belongs. But then finally, you have to say, what happened? And finally, God does come. God comes in the whirlwind and you say, aha! And what's God's statement? He says, who the blazes is this? You know? Come in. And there's nothing personal in that. who is this? And God comes, and God, just as Job predicted, he whirls in a grand and glorious whirlwind and overwhelms. And Job says, it's an absolutely wonderful speech, and I have no time to go through the speech. Except in the middle of it, God says to Job, and do you have to keep making me look wrong for you to be right? Job says, because he's being a bit overwhelmed, you know, this whirlwind floating around, things are God screaming from the sky, and Job's saying, I'm really pretty quite small, you know, because he knew that. And so it's very easy to sort of say, well, that big whirlwind is just a kind of blowing Job away and not really answering him. But the first thing is remarkable, that God does answer. Job has forced God's arm. Job is a heroic figure in this. He is this human being who, at the point of total and absolute innocence, forces God to have to appear and have to defend God's self. And while the defense is about, look, it's a great cosmos and the world is full of mysteries, Job, you'll never understand it all, which is one of the common answers, that's not quite where it all ends. It's important that it does go there because it forces the picture to be wider than just one person and God. It's a bigger picture. But at the very end of it all, after God, Job has gone through four chapters of, you know, self telling Job all the mysteries of the universe, and Job says, all right, you're pretty big and you've done a lot of things, you know, I didn't quite get it all, but then in 42 verse 6, which is sometimes, it's often very badly translated, mostly people say, oh, at the end of it all, Job confesses. Well, what's he got to confess? Nothing. It's not a confession of sin. It does not say, I have sinned. If you read it very carefully, it says, you can translate, the word is translated, I repent. But that's a bad translation. It basically says, I changed my mind. I withdraw my case. I'm not going to keep the court case going. Job ends the court case. He says, all right, it's just too difficult. It comes to terms with that reality is good. And you might say, well, that's a pretty weak ending, but that's not where it ends. Most people end it at 42:6, where Job ends the court case. But God doesn't stop. Then God comes into the scene, and it's a very short bit, but it's very crucial to the story. Because the story is linked both to the narrative as well as the poetry. God comes into the story, and who does God talk to? He talks to the three friends. The three friends here. He talks to the three friends, and he then gives the verdict. What's the verdict? What's the verdict? God gives the verdict after having a big tirade for four chapters. He finally gives the verdict. And he says, you three guys didn't say the truth about me. The way Job did. Job has spoken the truth. 42, 7, and 8. And that's not insignificant, is it? That Job, what Job experienced was true and real, and that his experience of God was that God had done this, and that was it. He was speaking honestly with integrity. He didn't touch it. There was no doctrinal, theological fudge. He said it, pulled it the way it was. And that's powerful. But if the three friends who didn't take it, tell it the way it was, are going to face things, then what has to happen? Job suddenly becomes the advocate for the three friends. Job has to kill a sacrifice and rescue them, redeem them. Isn't that extraordinary? He then has to have a sacrifice. And so the story ends, the key part of the story ends with all of these people in a healing meal, a reconciliation meal. So the story is, in this case, Job is vindicated. Even if he doesn't understand it all, he knows that what he had done in reclaiming his soul and crying for justice was true. True to who he was. True to what had happened. And God admits it at the end. God doesn't say, I was wrong, but God says, Job was right. Job spoke the truth, quote. That's an extraordinary story. It's an extraordinary story. Comments?
Glad to hear Jennifer.
Yeah. Jennifer? When I would preach about this after 4 weeks, people would always come up to me and say, I hope there's a happy ending. This is not a Hollywood story. However, when Jennifer finally came to terms with the fact that she could actually get to her uncle, found her uncle, and confronted her uncle, time and time again, and he said, you're a silly girl, you've made it all up, and totally wouldn't listen to her for a long time. But in the end, at a final major moment, she finally came to him and said, you have done it. I know you've done it. All of it was wrong. And now I am going, you have taken my soul, I'm going to take it back. No matter what you can do, you can't hurt me anymore because I'm reclaiming my soul. I'm taking it back. And because I've got it back, now I can look at you and say, I forgive you. She cried, and he cried. So would you invite Jennifer and her uncle to the Eucharist? The meal? It's the healing meal that ends it all. Healing meal that's crucial for all. And what I like to do is to say, Jesus went through all of this too. When Jesus was when Jesus was in the garden, people who were around him. Jesus is abandoned. He is the abandoned one. Every one of the steps of this, of denial, of screaming, my God, why have you forsaken me? Of abandonment by all the disciples, by the false accusation. What was Jesus accused of? What was Jesus accused of when he was brought before the Father?
Blasphemy.
One thing was blasphemy. The other thing was, quote, in Luke, the beginning of Luke 24, perverting the nation. All these false accusations. And did Jesus likewise go through the same, not only abandonment, but the sense of being falsely accused? Yes. So all the suffering that Jennifer and Job know, we know that we can experience, know that Jesus Christ experiences that same suffering. And that when he is on the cross, not only does he scream, why, not only does he go through the agony. And one text in Matthew, it says, I am so grieved, I feel close to what? Death. We've got the language of Jesus at the point of suicide as well. But in the end, when the man on the cross is there, the people are there, and all those people who have heard him, what does he say? Father,
forgive them.
And that power, that's the moment of power. When the one who is the victim, the survivor, claims back his soul, who he is, and then extends healing. And so the stories, the three stories have their connections. But to understand Job, you must, I believe, go through the sense of the trial, putting God on trial, and then having God at the end say, Job said the truth, and that people who do suffer innocently do not try to find something to blame, but accept their word, and then find the ways. And often it means far more counseling than a pastor can offer. Many psychiatric help, all kinds of things may be needed. But you need, if I'm going to be a counselor, I need to be able to say, I believe you, I'm with you, I'm going to let you reclaim your soul. I use that language because I think it's strong language and it works for some people. Now, I'm not going to ask people to share their situations. That's not what I'm here for. But if you want, later on at the healing ritual, if you want to be there, the prayers can be related precisely to what you're
doing. I have a comment and a question. And the comment is, I've never really thought of the Book of Job so much as focusing on bearing witness. You know, completely be willing to stay with a person and bear witness, and that compassion that you know, that the friends need to have. The other thing I want to ask about the service is, what if we want healing for somebody who's not here?
So,
okay, how do we kind of just
say to them what it is, and you become the vehicle.
Okay.
What I need to explain is that what I understand by blessing. And laying on hands, any blessing. Blessing in the ancient, in the Old Testament, in the biblical tradition, means the channeling of power. Transfer of power. So that the power, either from God, or from Christ, or from the body and the blood in the Eucharist, is the channeling of that power to the person. I am just a vehicle. I am just a mediator. and there's no way that I'm assuming that it's me. It's important that I see this as a vehicle, and to bless is to transfer power. It's not to say nice things or pray that things might be good or something. May you be happy. That's not a blessing. A blessing is a transfer of power. A curse is the opposite, transfer of destruction. So the blessing action is an action whereby the healing power of Christ, or the healing power of Christ's body and blood, is mediated that into you. And there used to be the laying on of hands in this earlier in the village years ago with the parent. It was quite common. Any other questions?
Or maybe just a comment. I know when hard transitions have gone through a person's life, many times, sometimes fortunately or unfortunately, either clergy or your close friends try to comfort you but use the wrong words.
Yeah. We talked about that last time. A lot of the wrong words are one expression that somebody used was, you know, like a little boy dies and they say, oh, Jesus wanted him for an angel. And that's kind of pious platitudes that hurt instead of helping.
Yeah. How do you respond if you're in that, if you're the one who's just received that message from that person who was trying to be helpful but is really not helpful to you? Do you just let that go?
Well, yeah.
Maybe that's an individual thing in that individual situation.
Initially, the best thing is to let it. Don't to jump in, because easily when we jump in, we often have not only heard, a bit of the story. And I had this history of jumping in, I have to get over it.
Well, I mean, like, if for me, if I'm going through a suffering in my life.
In your
life,
yes.
Like, I've been in that situation where I'm going through something and somebody has said to me, oh, you know, we may not understand God's plan right now, but, you know,
the final
God
breaking
is,
in heaven will end.
Yeah, or some such thing like that. And I'm thinking, thanks, it's not very helpful.
Yes, exactly. You know, you can either just simply let it pass, because that person simply doesn't know any better.
Right.
Or you can say, shove it. You feel better. Otherwise, you're just taking a book.
You probably prevent another person, too, from being able to think twice.
They'll think twice about saying it next time.
I sure will.
Yes.
Traditionally, Job, everybody identifies with the patience of Job.
The patience of Job is just Job's. The first chapter, Job is patiently saying pious things. After that, Job is the most impatient man. That's a totally ludicrous statement, because Job fights everybody, he fights his friends, he fights Eli, he fights God. He has a plan, but there's no sense of being. If you mean submissive by patience, forget it. It's not there. Yes. Yes.
Well, it seems like one thing that's unsatisfying in Job is the whole setup of the basic philosophical question of why these bad things are happening. And the mechanism of God and Satan shooting crafts is just really, how do you work?
Well, you need to recognize that the book of Job is a piece of classic literature. It's not history. Somebody is setting up the scene to be able to portray absolutely, unequivocally, that this is senseless suffering. It is meaningless suffering. And somebody is coming to terms with it. And you're absolutely right. We go back to the beginning of the book. You've got the Council of Heaven, and the Council meets. And Job is down here with his family and all the other things. And when the Council meets, Job has no idea that they're meeting. He is totally, not only innocent, but ignorant of the divine framing. Joe is framed. Here is God. And the council meets and he says, oh, welcome everybody, let's come to attention. Let's have, I call it, hey, you, have you been wandering over the earth checking things out? And the accuser says, oh, yeah, yeah, I've been. And God says, have you seen Job? Well, what a guy. what a man. And Satan says, oh, yeah, 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 I see it. He's got everything. And then what develops, of course, is this wager. And the accuser says, I'll bet if you take all of this away, then he'll curse you to your face. God says, I bet he won't. God gets sucked in. God gets sucked in. And Job is then framed. And he, everything is taken away in order for God to win this wager. And you see, that makes it unequivocally and totally innocent and unfair and senseless. The writer has set it up so you have to face the possibility that suffering will be senseless. He has brilliantly done so. You couldn't have had a more ridiculous. And when I say sucked in, don't think I am just being, popular. At the beginning of chapter 2, after they meet a second time, God says, all right, who won? Huh? You know, who won? And then God says, I admit I got sucked in. You, quote, sucked me in, incited me to do this. But look, I won nevertheless. And Satan says, oh yeah, of course, you won the first round, so I won. But look, take away his body, his health, it's covering with boils, and then you'll see. And God says, oh, all right, try it. Whoops, he gets sucked in a second. So you have, the point is not so much just how clever the writing is, that you've set up a perfect example of innocent suffering. And therefore, the whole thing is a human being and a reader trying to struggle with the question of innocent, unfair suffering all the way through the book.
I have a metaphor off of that. Is there any woman or females in that whole book at all?
Yeah, Job's wife. Now, Job's wife, when she sees him in this mess, she says, well, you know, there's one way out. A bit of euthanasia. She's euthanasia. You know, hers is a euthanasia act. You just simply curse God, why you said, and then zap.
It's over.
Yeah. But it doesn't quite ever get to the point of cursing. And so, Mrs. Job also sits on the sideline.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah, I'm not saying the book answers the philosophical question of why there is evil. No, it doesn't. It's an existential story. It's a real life struggle. This is how you struggle with it when you face it, not how do I answer it philosophically, theologically. It doesn't do that. Don't try and make it do that. It does is to say, this is a man, and these are the stages that he goes through, and maybe they are helpful as we go through.
It seems like it also stretches for the Israelis, or the Israelites, that not all suffering is retribution from God, because the prophets so often were explaining the suffering of the nation, that the nation had sinned and they would deserve what came to them.
But remember, this book is set before Abraham. It's set as a universal human. Mm-hmm. And while it's an Israelite text, it's a story that you'll find elsewhere as well in various forms, but basically is designed to be not simply an Israelite suffering, it's a human being suffering. It's a universal human.
Would you say it's archetypal?
Yes, it's archetypal, yes.
Do you find Douglas John Hall's distinctions on suffering and God and human suffering helpful? The legitimate and the illegitimate suffering that he talks about?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would recognize that we are responsible human beings. And we have to face the responsibility of our actions. So I talk about suffering as the result of irresponsible actions. And I would accept that. But what we've got here is a person who has done absolutely zero. And so you're facing a very different question. And totally senseless suffering happens with wars, all kinds of contexts. Senseless suffering happens. And there are innocent sufferers, you know, in every war, in every crisis, in every plague, it must be kind. Any final questions or comments before we move on and go to the Vespers? I hope that this has been a helpful exercise in going through with Job, Jennifer, and Jesus in a very rapid way, three stories and lives that have come to terms with disaster, in each case totally uncalled for, unfair, and unjust, but at the same time finding a way, not by some kind of pious platitudes, but by screaming at God, by facing God, and by reclaiming against great odds, that kind of message will help us in our own lives, but also if we seek to be counselors and help others. And if you wish to come to the healing after Vespers, we'll be next door. Thank you very much.
One of Job's friends talking, I can't remember where it is, but wild asses will become wise. No, wild asses, what is it? Yeah, stupid people will become wise, and wild asses are wrong.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Yes, it is. At the beginning of each speech, there's some caustic comments which are quite sarcastic. There's a lot of sarcasm. Before they get to the theology, they start with sarcasm.
Yeah, it's funny.
I brought that to you. How about that?
Thank you.
Okay. From what? Just walking. You want to go and sit by mommy or me there?
Was it good?
Yeah.
Oh, should I go to the chair?
Oh, yes, please. I've got to set the next room up for a minute. Okay.
Need help? Mom.
Go with mommy.
Mom.
Okay.